Welcome to Dear Poetry, where you send us your problems or the things that you're grappling with, and we offer you lyrical guidance. To know why poetry can offer some of the best advice, I want to tell you about this one German book that was mailed to me by my godfather when I was 14. He was a minister in former communist East Germany and drove one of those old Trabi cars. You know what I'm talking about if you saw the movie Goodbye Lenin or The Lives of Others? They're these mini cheap-looking beige cars that always look like they're just about to fall apart. He didn't look like what you might expect a minister to look. He always wore a beret and carried this brown pleather briefcase. He was equal parts wit, rebellion, and heart. He'd talk a mile a minute cracking jokes about the East German secret police, and then he'd turn around to give the bus driver a bar of chocolate to thank her for taking me to the right destination. But the thing that made him so superbly cool to me as a 14-year-old was that, unlike most adults I knew, he never tried to lecture me or proselytize. The book he sent me from Germany to Southern California wasn't a Bible or book of prayers. It was a collection of poems written by his favorite poet and satirist, Erich Kästner, an atheist and pacifist who heavily criticized Hitler Germany and chronicled the country's crimes and destruction. The book was titled Dr. Erich Kästner's Lyrische Hausapotheke, or Dr. Erich Kästner's Lyrical Apothecary. And in it were poems sorted by ailment. The table of contents read, quote, "If aging is putting you in a bad mood, turn to page 21, 56, 60, and 92. Or, if you're witnessing poverty, turn to pages 42, 54, and 58. And once the know-it-alls have finally finished lecturing, turn to pages 32, 76, 105, and on and on. I was riveted. And so was my godfather. He knew most of the poems by heart. In fact, he knew so many poems by heart, he could spend all day reciting one after the other. He'd just interrupt our conversation mid-sentence and start. Here's audio from one of the last videos I took of him.
Lucia.
We couldn't get the Trabi car to start. But then, finally, the motor started running. And pretty soon, we're driving through a forest, and everywhere around us are fall-colored leaves. So right in the middle of our conversation, he starts reciting Rilke's poem, Autumn. It's about the fall, and also about dying. The leaves are falling, falling like they're coming from afar, from distant gardens, withered in heaven, he's saying. And then eventually he goes on, thus everything must fall. This hand here must fall, and this other one too. Falling is in everything. He died a year later, in autumn. I often joke that he wasn't my godfather, but my poetry father. He cited more poems and raunchy jokes than Bible verses, and I think he found at least as much wisdom and delight in them. That's something I've been looking for a lot lately, especially as I report the news, especially in this huge public health crisis. I'm a reporter for the Washington Post, and though I know that facts and statistics and well-researched information can illuminate the world's biggest dilemmas, it's poetry I turn to for the tender stuff of life. Perhaps if we all spent more time turning to those nebulous parts of our lives, then maybe I'd be reporting better news. Anyways, that's my hope, and that's what this show is about. On Dear Poetry, you send us your problems, questions, or whatever's on your mind, and on each episode, we invite a poet to respond. problems can be tiny, like your left shoe doesn't fit quite right, or you're stuck at home and it feels like the walls are about to implode on you. Or they can be big too, like you're feeling drained by endless news updates or struggling with heartache in one of its infinite forms. Here's our first problem, sent by a friend.
Oh, Louisa, guess where I am?
She's taking a little breather in Amsterdam, walking through those cute cobblestone streets.
Ooh, I'm putting my other glove back on.
I'll let her tell you the rest.
I started reflecting on where I'm going next and what I've been experiencing these past 6 months, what I've been thinking about, and then like pretty quickly to what I haven't been thinking about. And the biggest thing that I haven't been thinking about, I don't want to place any judgment on myself, but maybe enough, is my dad. And what's happening with dad right now is he's actually, he's kind of so far along in his disease, not only alcoholism, but also all these other layers of physical ailments, which have come about, some because of the drinking and others not, that he's pretty much full-time in a nursing home with an Alzheimer's diagnosis, among many other diagnoses. And for the first time in his life, he's being medicated. And Louisa, he's so sweet. He's so kind right now. And he's so in the moment. With my dad, whenever I'd call him, it would always be like I'd have 5 minutes before he'd like need to get back to work and always be, what's your plan? But now when I spend time with him, he just wants to be. He just wants to sit and be. And he's just happy to be together. And he's smiling. And it's really beautiful. And there's this bittersweetness and this knowing that it's the end, or getting close to the end. But the thing with alcoholism is there's always near ends around every corner. And knowing that I've like lost him in a lot of ways, but I'm also, you know, with him in some ways that I haven't been before. And I was really wishing in this poetry corner that there were some works by some authors who could speak specifically to alcoholism, maybe even to having alcoholics in your life who you love.
Listening to this really, really got me. And I feel so much for this person. And
this is our guest poet, Jane Flett. She's the author of an amazing poetry collection called Fool's Journey. She also teaches at a writing space here in Berlin called The Reader. That's where I met her. And she's one of the recipients of the Berlin Senate stipend for literature. I asked her to choose a poem in response to our caller, who we're calling Always Near Ends in this show.
When I read this, I just wanted to hug you and say, don't be harsh on yourself. Please don't be harsh on yourself right now. I think just struck me this thing that you were talking about, this always being near an ending and there always being another ending and another corner. And the poem I wanted to read for you, it's not necessarily strictly about alcoholism, but I think it speaks very much to this idea of sitting with a person that you care about very much. And it's called Bottom of the Ocean. It's a poem where the narrator is talking about his former roommate and the conversations they had.
Here's the poem. It's by the American poet Bob Hickok, and it's from his poetry collection called Insomnia Diary. It's about someone who's struggling with mental illness.
At least once, you should live with someone more medicated than yourself. A tall man, he closed his eyes before he spoke, stocked groceries at night and heard voices. We were eating cereal the first time, cream of wheat. He said that she said we're all out of evers, without explaining who she was or how many evers we had to begin with or where they were kept. I slept with an extra blanket that night. This was strange, but that year I had to read Plato for a grade. Each circle's the bastard child of a perfect O, I remember he said. And Kierkegaard, I thought, was writing stand-up with the self is a relation which relates itself to its own self. But my roommate nodded as I read this aloud. He'd stood so long before carnival mirrors that the idea of a face being a reflection of itself was common sense. On the calendar, the striptease of months, dust quietly gathering on the shoulders of older dust. And because he'd not taken the microwave apart and strapped its heart to its head, or talked to the 60-watt bulb on the porch, he thought he was better and flushed his pills. Soon he was back, where windows are mesh, and what's sharp is banished, and what can be thrown is attached. So unless you can lift the whole building, everyone is safe. We had lunch a year later. Or he spun the creamer and wore skin made of glass while I ate a sandwich. And by that, I mean I was hungry and he was sealed in amber. A call of drugs meant to withstand ants and fire, nor did his mouth work but to hold words in. I'd wanted to know all that time what happened to our evers, to ask if he remembered what he said and explain to him he was an oracle that day. I wanted him to tell me about the woman who whispered or screamed that our chances were up, because the phrase had stayed in my life as a command to survive myself. That was the day I'd learned you can sit with someone who's on the bottom of the ocean and not get wet. By the time he said things were good, he'd poured 12 sugars into a coffee he never touched. I think some of the things that spoke to me and that I thought that could relate to this idea of because he'd not taken the microwave apart and strapped his heart to his head or talked to the 60-watt bulb, he thought he was better and flushed his pills. And then soon he was back. And this, it's not something I have the most personal experience with, but in dealing with alcoholics and this idea about the near ends, I think there's something really difficult there in people think that they're better and they stop taking the actions that they need to do in order to be better. And so the cycle repeats. And I think being around that is incredibly difficult. And yeah, my heart aches for you going through that and going through that with your father. And I really just love this line in it about, I learned you can sit with someone who's on the bottom of the ocean and not get wet. And yeah, that's what I want to say to you. Like when you were there and that you were there and just sitting with your father in these moments, do that. It's okay. It's better than okay. That's the thing that you can do. And that's beautiful. And just sit there and be.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's also this line that stood out to me. We were eating cereal the first time, cream of wheat. And it's so simple, but the sort of detail of being cream of wheat, this like very soft, warm dish, and like we were eating it together. It's just that detail of such a gentle thing and such a specific experience they shared together. And it made me think of the tenderness that you describe always near ends that you're experiencing with your father, to also try to enjoy every detail of that, because it's even though maybe he will change again and maybe he will relapse or maybe he will get worse or maybe he will get better. You don't know. But to enjoy that tenderness that you're experiencing for the first time with him and just to take it for what it is.
Yeah. I also thought that idea of him being present for the first time stands really in opposition to this idea here of the idea of a face being a reflection of itself. Mm. And I feel there are these points where people are lost to us or where people are distant to us in this idea of a reflection. And the fact that you have this time of presence and of actually being there, that's so beautiful and so valuable. And yeah.
Yeah, totally. Do you think there's also this this line he said that she said we're all out of evers?
I love it.
Which I love so much. And at first I thought about whether, you know, he's made promises in the past over and over again of sticking to something forever, and that we're out of that because maybe those promises have been broken. But I don't know. How did you read that line?
I mean, what the thing I really like in that line is the ambiguity in it. We don't know who she is. We don't know how many evers we had. But yeah, I definitely see that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of, are we ever going to do this? Is this forever?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I see that aspect of it. And yeah, I like this idea of the subject of the poem is in the middle of this network of so many people who all care about him and who have these different dynamics with him. And I feel there's also a sense that he lets them and himself down in different ways, which is really sad. But there's also this affection and love that continues throughout it.
Yeah.
That's really nice. One last thing that I was thinking is this moment in the poem of I wanted him to tell me about the woman who whispered or screamed that our chances were up, because the phrase had stayed in my life as a command to survive myself. And that moment also really struck me because the poem is very focused throughout on the fragility and vulnerability of the roommate, of the one who's in the mental hospital, who's going through these things. But this is this moment where I felt this moment of vulnerability within the narrator as well, and that something had come from their interaction that had given the narrator the strength when they had their own mental problems and difficult times and dark thoughts. And I guess to come back to our dear letter writer is, you know, look after yourself as well as looking after him. You can have these moments together, but yeah, survive yourself and protect yourself within it as well. And maybe by looking for yourself in this, the time that you do spend together with him can be free of the weight of obligation or the weight of feeling, I'm doing this because I feel bad and I have to. And you can just enjoy sitting in that moment together where he's present, and sitting, whether it's the bottom of the ocean or just wherever.
One more time, let's sit back with the full poem again. Bottom of the Ocean by Bob Hickok and read by Jane Flett.
At least once you should live with someone more medicated than yourself. A tall man, he closed his eyes before he spoke, stocked groceries at night and heard voices. We were eating cereal the first time, cream of wheat. He said that she said we're all out of evers, without explaining who she was or how many evers we had to begin with or where they were kept. I slept with an extra blanket that night. This was strange, but that year I had to read Plato for a grade. Each circle's the bastard child of a perfect O, I remember he said. And Kierkegaard, I thought, was writing stand-up with the self is a relation which relates itself to its own self. But my roommate nodded as I read this aloud. He'd stood so long before carnival mirrors that the idea of a face being a reflection of itself was common sense.
On the calendar, the striptease of months. Dust quietly gathering on the shoulders of older dust. And because he'd not taken the microwave apart and strapped its heart to its head, or talked to the 60-watt bulb on the porch, he thought he was better and flushed his pills. Soon he was back, where windows are mesh, and what's sharp is banished, and what can be thrown is attached. So unless you can lift the whole building, everyone is safe. We had lunch a year later. Or he spun the creamer and wore skin made of glass while I ate a sandwich. And by that, I mean I was hungry and he was sealed in amber. A call of drugs meant to withstand ants and fire, nor did his mouth work but to hold words in. I'd wanted to know all that time what happened to our Evers, to ask if he remembered what he said and explain to him he was an oracle that day. I wanted him to tell me about the woman who whispered or screamed that our chances were up, because the phrase had stayed in my life as a command to survive myself. That was the day I learned you can sit with someone who's on the bottom of the ocean and not get wet. By the time he said things were good, he'd poured 12 sugars into a coffee he never touched.
Thank you to Always Near Ends, who sent us their message, and to Jane Flett for responding to it with such care. Thank you also to poet Bob Hickok for letting us read the poem on the show, and to Ben Osborne for your beautiful music. Thank you to all my editors, advisors, and confidants who helped me make this show, including Joe Rosenberg, Avery Truffleman, Eva van der Giesen, Anna Adlerstein, Rachel Hamburg, Alyssa Jones-Nelson, Brooke Watkins, Ron Kirchner, Cynthia Guerrero, Anya Krieger, Kony Kim, Tony Liu, Kathleen Heil, Ben Miller, Catherine Raimondo, and the many, many friends who lent me their voices, ears, and enthusiasm in making it happen. You can learn more about Dear Poetry on our website, dearpoetry.space. You can also follow me on Twitter at Louis Beck and send us a voicemail or a written dilemma to askdearpoetry@gmail.com. You can also call the toll-free number 1-833-POETRY-D. That's 1-833-7-638-793. You can also send us feedback, your favorite poems, poets, or whatever else is on your mind. You can find Ben Osborne's music at ben-osborne.com and follow him on Twitter at tangled_hair. Thank you so much for listening. Till soon.